Welcome to Season 5 of the Fashion Law Network podcast. I'm your host, Kasia Zabrowska-Traubin, patent attorney and fashion enthusiast based in Los Angeles, California. Join me as I break down legal cases, discuss recent fashion news, and demystify patent law. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 5 of the Fashion Law Network podcast. I just wanted to give a quick thank you to all my loyal listeners who have been on this journey with me since season one back in 2020. And of course, all my new listeners who are constantly discovering my podcast all over the world. I get some of the kindest messages from my listeners. Some tell me that they had no idea about this area of the law, how it intersects with fashion. And lots of listeners are getting inspired to get into patent and intellectual property law. So that's amazing. I love doing this podcast. I've always loved researching the legal behind the scenes of my favorite fashion houses. And it's just such a cool feeling that there are so many people around the world who share my interest. It's still astounding to me that I have listeners in over 50 countries around the world. So on this episode, I'm going to delve into the world of luxury perfumes. My interest was piqued in this subject when I read about the lawsuit that Chanel initiated against a Chinese perfume company, Chanel No. 5 versus Chanel No. 9, and Chanel won this lawsuit. So it kind of got me thinking about the various issues that go along with the perfume world. Can you patent a perfume? Can you trademark a scent? So keep listening and you'll learn the answer to all these questions and more. There's been a really interesting shift in luxury fashion house sales in recent years. Clothing used to be a fashion brand's main source of sales, so-called their bread and butter. But that is no longer. And now the reality is that all the large fashion houses make the most of their profit from perfumes, beauty, and handbags. So these relationship roles have been completely reversed. And I've also noticed that naturally there's been a lot more litigation in the fragrance and beauty products of various luxury fashion houses. I'm sure you guys have seen this trend too. This whole new reversal of relationship roles in the fashion world is really crystallized by a quote by Gram Gafasalia. He's the chief executive of the brand Vetements, and he gave this quote to a Women's Wear Daily article back in 2017. So this is kind of when the ball started rolling on this new relationship here. So he said, "Today, fashion shows have nothing to do with clothes anymore. Most of the looks are not even produced and therefore never get to the shop floor. Shows there are merely to sell a dream that at the end of the day will sell a perfume in a duty-free store." According to strategystory.com, clothes and fashion shows are really just a marketing strategy for most luxury brands, especially for houses like Gucci and Dior, the really established ones. Most of the clothes seen in Fashion Week aren't sold in stores, and the goal of ready-to-wear lines is actually to not lose too much money. So let alone make any profit, they're just concerned about not losing too much money. And the real stream of revenue, as I mentioned before, is the perfumes, bags, sometimes jewelry, depending on the fashion house. And the article goes on to say that the clothes and the decadent shows guard the brand's exclusivity. At the core of luxury is the feeling of being in an exclusive club and sometimes associating with someone important, like a celebrity. It's emotional marketing at its finest. Instead of directly marketing the real product, the luxury markets, they kind of advertise that dream and the aura of being fabulous, kind of like that dream that they show in a fashion show with the models. The first luxury product that a new earner buys is almost always a perfume or a beauty product. Of course, for example, a Chanel dress costs like $10,000 to $20,000, depending on the dress. Chanel bags are around $5,000 now, also really expensive, but their lipsticks are $30 and the perfumes are $80. So if there's a Chanel fan who's entering the market, of course, they're probably going to start with the lower priced lines like that. Now, Chanel No. 5 is the most famous perfume in the world. Town & Country came out with an interesting article on the most popular perfumes in the world. Chanel No. 5 was, of course, number one. Dolce & Gabbana Light Blue was number two. Shalimar by Guerlain was number three. Interesting. Oh, and Chloe by the Chloe Fashion House. I think the perfume is just called Chloe was number four. So that's interesting because that one is relatively new. So now let's begin with some history of the most famous perfume in the world, Chanel No. 5. BBC.com had a great piece on the history. So I'll just summarize it here because the history is so rich of this perfume and detailed that I think I could do a whole hour-long episode just on that. Now, we can't get into the history of the Chanel No. 5 perfume without first getting into a brief biography of its founder, Miss Coco Chanel, of course. According to biography.com, it all started back in 1883 when Coco Chanel was born, and her real name was Gabrielle Bonheur Chanel, and she was born in Western France. She had what seems like a really difficult childhood. Her mother died when she was only 12. Her father was a peddler, and he put her into an orphanage, probably because he was unable to care for Coco. And in the orphanage, she was raised by nuns who taught her how to sew. And it's also reported that that's where she got her nickname, Coco, instead of her real name, Gabrielle, and that it was a name she chose for herself as a stage name during her brief career as a singer. So then when Coco was about 20 years old, she met a friend who helped her start a hat business, and she opened her first shop selling hats on Paris's famed Rue Cambon in 1910, so she was only 27 at the time. And then she added a few stores in other cities in France and started making And by the 1920s, Coco Chanel was already kind of a phenomenon in the French social circles. And at this point in time, she wanted to create a scent that would kind of describe the new modern woman that she aspired to be. And the smell of soap and freshly scrubbed skin was something that always stuck with her, as that was kind of the smell that she associated when she was in that convent orphanage with the nuns. She was supposedly known as being a very clean person, and that later when she worked among the mistresses of the rich and famous, she complained about the way they smelled. So she decided to commission a perfume for some of her best clients, and it was important that this perfume smelled of freshness, but she had trouble finding a perfumer who could help her achieve this. Frederick Malle, who's a perfume editor, he also has a few perfumes, is quoted as saying, "In those days, the only way to create a fresh fragrance was to use citrus, like lemon and orange. Those things are fresh, but they don't last for a very long time on the skin." Now, according to the BBC.com article, at that time, chemists had already isolated chemicals called aldehydes, which could artificially create these fresh kind of smells. But they were very powerful, so perfumers were kind of hesitant to use them. In the late summer of 1920, Chanel went on a holiday to the Côte d'Azur, France, with her boyfriend, Grand Duke. And there she heard of a perfumer called Ernest Beau, and he had worked with the Russian royal family and lived in France in a town called Grasse, which at the time was the center of the world's perfume industry. So Beau was interested in Coco's challenge for this new fresh perfume that she was seeking to make. And it took him several months to perfect this fragrance. And eventually he came up with 10 samples and gave them to Coco Chanel. He numbered them 1 to 5 and then 20 to 24. And she chose sample number 5 as being her favorite. So that's obviously how Chanel No. 5 got its name. And it's rumored that this number 5 sample was actually the result of a lab mistake, in that Beau's assistant added a dose of aldehyde in such a huge quantity that was never used before. And then Chanel later said, "It was what I was waiting for, perfume like nothing else. The scent infused with jasmine, rose, sandalwood, and vanilla was an instant success." And it's rumored that Chanel invited Beau and some of her friends to a popular restaurant on the French Riviera to celebrate, and she sprayed the perfume all around the table. And supposedly every woman stopped by and asked where this fragrance was from. And that was the first moment that anybody in the public had smelled number five. And it supposedly just literally stopped everybody in their tracks. And from that moment, it was kind of like a groundbreaking moment in history of the perfume. I can just imagine that scene in the south of France, everybody just stopping around the perfume table, smelling amazing. So now that we have some background on the history of how Chanel No. 5 came about, let's discuss the legal side of fragrances, intellectual property in particular. Now, the most surprising aspect of the legal protection that I think you guys will also be interested in is the fact that a scent can actually be trademark protected, to a certain extent, of course. So you can actually trademark a scent as long as it's not a functional aspect of your product. So in other words, if your product is a perfume or air freshener and you want to trademark it, the actual scent of it, then you can't. But if your product is not a perfume or air freshener, for example, then you most likely can trademark the scent. For example, there's a trademark for the Plumeria scent for sewing thread that was registered back in 1990. Another famous example is Play-Doh. That company successfully trademarked the scent of their Play-Doh. So the scent of Play-Doh was not functional, of course, but was distinct to the product. Basically, that means you don't need the scent of Play-Doh to use it. You can still, you know, play with it in your hands, mold it, doesn't matter how it smells. And Play-Doh's scent trademark is described as, quote, sweet, slightly musky vanilla fragrance with slight overtone of cherry combined with the smell of a salted wheat-based dough. So the bottom line is, if you have a product that doesn't require a scent to function but has a distinctive scent anyway, you can get a trademark registration for that. Okay, now let's turn to copyrights. Can you copyright a fragrance? In the U.S., the U.S. Copyright Act provides that, quote, copyright protection subsists in accordance with this title in original works of authorship fixed in any tangible medium of expression now known or later developed. The requirement of originality requires that the work owes its origin to the author, meaning it's independently created and, of course, not copied from other works. Surprisingly, the issue of the copyrightability of a perfume has not yet been addressed by any courts in the United States, but we do have some guidance from a few European court cases here. So back in 2006, a Dutch court ruled that a perfume can have a copyright. And this was illustrated in a landmark case where Lancôme sued a copycat perfume company for a scent of their famous Lancôme Tresor perfume. And the Dutch court ruled for Lancôme. A court in France has also issued a few decisions on copyright issues in terms of fragrances, and there have been a few cases which concluded that a fragrance is not copyrightable, but there was one regarding the perfume Angel by Thierry Mugler, which used to be like my trademark fragrance for years when I was in college. And in that case, the court concluded the perfume is in fact copyrightable. In 1999, the court ruled that the perfume Angel was not merely a product of technical skill, but constituted an original work and was thereby eligible for copyright protection in that case. And the French court compared the experience of smelling a perfume to listening to the varying nature of music that is susceptible to the environment of the listener or wearer. So that was a really interesting analysis that the French court went into, and I will post a link to that in the episode notes of this episode if anybody would like to read that in detail. It almost reads like a poem or something. It's so beautiful. And now let's turn to patents. Can you patent a fragrance? So we find guidance to this in 35 U.S. Code 101, which provides, whoever invents or discovers any new and useful process, machine, manufacture, or composition of matter, or any new and useful improvement thereof, may obtain a patent, therefore subject to the conditions and requirements of this title. And then it goes on to give examples. So according to this code, perfumes are not patentable because they are not a, quote, new and useful process, machine, manufacture, composition of matter. However, the composition of the perfume, meaning the list of specific ingredients used to make a perfume, are patentable. So, bottom line is the scent is not patentable, but that unique composition of the ingredients of the perfume may be eligible for patent protection. And the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office even has created a whole classification system that deals with perfume scents. So those who invent new perfumes often, however, don't seek to patent them because a part of filing for a patent application requires, of course, the disclosure of all the ingredients that would go into your perfume. And then, of course, patent applications become public after a pretty short amount of time. So a lot of perfume makers have to choose whether it's in their best interest to patent their perfume and risk the ingredients becoming public. So you really have to kind of weigh the pros and cons of filing a patent for a perfume ingredient. And another form of patent protection, of course, is design patent protection. And I would say most, if not all, perfume companies tend to get a design patent for the design of the perfume bottle, for example. So design patents protect that kind of ornamental nature of the invention only. So now this brings us to the legal analysis portion of the episode, where I'll be focusing on the recent lawsuit that Chanel brought against a copycat perfumer based in China, whose perfume was called Number 9 Flower of Story, made by Chinese fragrance producer Yu Story of Love Cosmetics Company Limited. And according to the photos submitted in this court case that I looked at, they submitted photos of both the Chanel No. 5 bottle, which kind of looks like a whiskey kind of decanter bottle, rectangle shape with that rectangle stopper, and this Love Story perfume bottle, which has a very similar shape. And they also showed photos of the outer packaging of both perfumes, being that white rectangular box with the black writing around it. I wrote the story a few months ago, so I'm going to be getting most of my information from them, since I tried to obtain the Chinese court papers in this court case, but they were only available in Chinese. So once this lawsuit was filed in China, the Chinese Intermediate People's Court, which I think is like our district court, ruled that the trademark design of the two perfumes had obvious similarities so that consumers could mistakenly connect defendants, which is the Number 9 perfume, with the Chanel No. 5. Therefore, the court decided that the Number 9 perfume Flower of Story Company shall immediately stop selling that Number 9 perfume and pay Chanel in damages. And then the IPKitten.com site has a quote from the Chinese court translated into English, and it states, "The letters on the outer box of the infringing goods are not consistent with the Chanel No. 5 perfume, but their color scheme and black lines outline are at the same position. The position of the text markings and the size of the text ratio is highly consistent, and the letters are also less visually distinct for domestic consumers who are native speakers of Chinese characters. And the box of Chanel No. 5 perfume constitutes a close resemblance. In addition, it is sold together with the perfume bottle contained in the box, which is more likely to cause the relevant public to misidentify." So, the Flower of Story did not like this decision, and they appealed it to the Chinese High People's Court with the following arguments. And these arguments I found from hfgip.com. So, the Flower of Story said that, tried to argue that consumers use the trademark Number 5 in Chanel on the perfume packaging to distinguish the source of goods instead of the perfume bottle or the design itself. And the perfume bottle of Chanel is not distinctive. The defendant provided evidence on the design of similar outer packaging box with black outlines and white color, trying to prove that Chanel's outer package is not distinctive. And the court here stated, and I'm quoting again here from the English translation from one of the websites, though the packaging and decoration is the inner packaging and decoration of the Chanel perfume, but based on the special nature of the perfume and its publicity and sales, the promotion will generally be accompanied by the promotion of a perfume bottle. So basically meaning that the packaging and bottle kind of go hand in hand. It can be determined that the inner packaging and decoration has had a certain influence and is protectable under Article 6. So interestingly, that court supported the love story defendant's argument on the non-distinctiveness of the outer packaging. On the one hand, the main identifying part of the packaging is that black frame on a white background and the arrangement. However, Chanel prevailed overall, since the court did state that the actual perfume bottle may mislead consumers. And on that note, let's conclude episode 1 of season 5. As always, thank you so much for tuning in, and please stay tuned for episode 2 of season 5 soon. Thank you.